and welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Jason, WF2N, will be your co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder, and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simpler URL to find it, you can just type puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. As always, an application is available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try my best to provide an answer, and Jason, WF2N, will join in. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for any future topics of interest, please let us know here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, Jason WF2N. Good evening, Jason.
Good evening, Roy, and good evening, everyone on the net.
Well, let the festivities begin. If anyone has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, this is the time to hit that push-to-talk button and give me your call sign, and whether it's a question or a comment. Looks like it's going to be one of those nights. I guess we had a little touch of spring fever on the 10-meter net this Sunday morning. It's not really as warm or as sunny, people are still suffering from it. So once again, I will ask if anyone out there has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight. This is going to be a very short technical net. I usually don't come bearing concepts to discuss because I don't want this to be a monologue. We have an interesting TechNet puzzle tonight. If anyone is reading it or looking at the website, and it's a very practical question that's asked a lot of times on the HF and on the UHF and VHF band. The question is basically: if your monitor on your computer distorts when you transmit on 80 meters, or it could be any frequency, what would be the best measure to take to remove it? And the choices are given, there's four choices. The first choice, A, is reduce the resolution of the monitor. B is reboot the computer. C is change to a screened main lead. And C is fit some ferrite rings to the cables between the monitor and the computer. So I hope people kind of think about that for a little while. I would hate to go directly to the puzzle. Again, not quite sure if anyone would want to play the puzzle if no one wants to check in with any questions. So we'll just kind of leave it floating for the time being. And hopefully, as I've been babbling on, more people have remembered that it's Wednesday night and time for the technical net. So if anyone has any questions or topics or or things that they'd like to say on this TechNet, feel free.
Hi, this is Jason, WF2N. I've got a question, if no one else does.
Hey, Jason, please ask.
Okay, so I've heard... Well, okay, I'll just go on with the question here. What is a Maunder minimum, and are we in or heading toward one?
What you're basically trying to predict the future. The problem is that we don't know a great deal about the solar cycle. We know they're approximately 11 years. That's a major solar cycle where it goes from spot peak down to minimum, back up to peak again. There are other cycles with that are much, much longer that are kind of built into that too, or at least we've inferred it from geological findings that kind of speak that over the more historical range of time. But there's so much that we don't know. There is no proof per se that we are in a bigger cycle that will cause either a absence of a sunspot cycle when it should come in about six or so years, or if it's going to be a minimum, if it's going to be a low intensity, as the last cycle, I believe it was 24, was a very strange one. It was sort of weak and it was kind of two-tipped. It kind of bounced a little bit one year, then went down, then bounced a little bit the second year, and then started to fall. But the maximum was never as high as previous cycles. So this is a long way of saying the short answer of we don't have the faintest idea. People will have wonderful 2020 hindsight when we're in the midst of the next sunspot cycle of whether this is one of those feared, almost non-existent minimums within the cycle, but we don't know. Well, it'll be interesting to see. I'm somewhat optimistic. It's been consistent for many, 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 many years. I don't see any particular reason why the sun should act out right now. But we'll see.
All right. Thanks for the answer, Roy. Appreciate it.
No problem. Anyone have any further questions or topics or comments for the technical net tonight?
Sure.
I'd like to check in. Good evening, Roy. People, I heard Gene. Welcome to the technical net, Gene.
Hi, thank you, Jason. I have a question regarding the radio. When you power off, is it bad just powering off to the power supply? Because when I did that to the FTM 400, the screen slowly disappears.
Things being equal, it's probably best to turn devices off with the power button. If it's a well-designed piece of electronics, it shouldn't make that much of a difference because the designers should have thought that people were going to kill the power and have safety measures because, as we all know, all of our equipment is full of inductors and capacitors. They store up electrical charge in the case of capacitors. They store up magnetic field strength in the case of inductors, and when you remove the power supply, you cause a sudden shock to the system where you develop back currents and all kinds of fun things. But a well-designed system will have quenching diodes and resistors and such in line that allow the capacitors to safely discharge and the back current of inductors to safely discharge. All things being equal, once again, I would suggest people get into the habit of turning the power switch off, because that's the way they designed it. There's usually a little housekeeping measures that are programmed into modern radios where they shift a volatile memory storage into non-volatile, and they get ready to go to sleep. But if you buy good equipment, it probably is not too traumatic to pull the cord on it. As I would suggest no one ever do that with a computer. But with the radio gear, again, if it's well engineered, you should get away with it, but try hitting the power button first.
Understood, but they're not pulling the cord, but you shut off the power supply, the power supply slowly drains down. That's the part I think that's bad for the radio.
Not necessarily bad. What's happening is, yeah, you have a capacitor that's slowly discharging the disconnect. And so it's bleeding off its current in the light display, and as it bleeds off, the intensity will dim, and then go out. That's probably not as problematic as the back current of relays and transformers and other inductive parts, because those will just kind of pour intense pulses of power back as back current. And you'll see every so often, if you look at schematics of some electronic equipment, there are these diodes that are placed around relay coils. And the reason why they're placed that way is if a current if a back current develops in the opposite direction than the current applied to the relays, it shorts out that current and dampens it, so it doesn't cause too many problems elsewhere. So the capacitor discharging, it's probably not great, but it's not terrible. It's the inductors that probably do the most damage.
All right, and thank you, Jason, for stepping in.
Gene, someone else checked in as Gene was checking in, so if you could give me your name and your call sign.
Good evening, Nick, N2A3R.
Nick, do you have any questions or comments for the technical net tonight?
No, I just wanted to say hello. I actually didn't know the TechNet was on tonight, but I had on frequency and I heard you, so I just wanted to say hello. And that's about it. Nothing I can think of at the moment.
Very good, Nick. We're here usually the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. And we actually archive this stuff and stick it on the Kings County Radio Club website, and you're always welcome. It's a little bit different than the Limark Technical Net. We don't have one guy that keeps on asking questions about distant DX TVing and circulators and such. But I hope you'll find it entertaining. And this is AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, held on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Does anyone have any questions or comments or topics that they would like to discuss or have discussed on this Technical Net tonight?
N2HVR. Just a rundown. All right, so I have a hotspot, right, connected to my computer, and, I use it for Fusion and whatnot. When I bought it back in July of 2017, I was using a D-Star, Reflector 001, and it was working fine for about 6 months, and then all of a sudden, I could not link to Reflector 001. Now, I believe it's not on my end, but I believe it's on the reflector's end, as if they're blocking people. I was just wondering if you knew, or if anybody out there could hear the sound of my voice, knows what's going on D-Star Reflector 001, because when I first set it up, it was working great, I had no problem, but now every time I try to link to it, my computer just sits there and just tries to link, but never links to it. Back to you, Rick.
Very good, Nick. I'll throw it out to the audience. I believe some other people listening here have hotspots. I've played a little bit with them. I haven't really played that much with D-Star with them. I've tried working Yaesu, but for the most part, I've been playing around with DMR with it. And it very well could be that the people in charge of different reflectors are getting a lot of traffic that they don't want from hotspots, and so they might be doing some measure to block people out. I'm not fully aware of the D-Star reflector situation, but I will open it to the rest of the people listening If anyone knows anything about hotspots in relation to D-Star reflectors and whether or not they're being disabled by the owners, please feel free. I'm sorry, Nick. It's a combination of things. I think most people in this area tend to kind of focus either on the fusion, because our repeater is a fusion technology repeater, and there seems to be a lot of activity going on DMR. I really haven't talked to that many people. Many years ago, when I first got my license 7 years ago, D-Star was the latest, greatest digital technology, and there were a lot of people going on it and talking about the different reflectors. But at least in the metropolitan area, as far as I'm aware, other than K2DIG in the city, I don't think there is another D-Star. And I realize that you're on a hot spot, so you don't need a repeater. You go directly to the internet connection.
I mean, I've gotten conflicting reports from people that do use D-Star, and they're not even sure. I was just wondering, since I was thought about it, since you were asking, I figured let me bring it up, and maybe somebody's out there, but I've gotten conflicting reports. Actually, I've tried some experiments. Instead of using, I have Spectrum, so I have, like, internet to Spectrum. Instead of using that, what I tried was using my phone, which is Verizon, and I have a Samsung 8 Plus, and I tried to use, I tethered my hotspots on my computer, instead of through my internet, which I have in the house, I used my Verizon phone, and I actually got some results. So I'm thinking it may not be me in particular, but it may be the type of internet connection that you're using that they don't like. It could be causing, for all I know, it could be causing interference on their end. You know, so they don't, and I've heard this from other people, that they can block out, you know, if they want to, people that own the reflectors can just block it out. Maybe they only want a certain section of the country using their repeater. They don't want everybody coming in on their reflector and just making a lot of noise. Who knows?
There's so many different levels of it getting blocked, such as the nature of computers and internet protocols and such. They could block it at the server on their end using whatever area they feel like. They have a list of people who are registered with D-Star, so they could double-check it and only allow certain groups of people or something. Also, as you were suggesting, it is possible for internet providers to block certain ports. There was a thought of doing that back in the bad old days when torrenting was a big pirating problem, and a lot of internet providers threatened to block the usual ports that the torrent software worked, although it wouldn't have worked because they would have just gone to a different port. So it could be some port limitation of your provider. I found that to be a problem sometimes with EchoLink, depending upon how EchoLink is configured from the repeaters that are the servers. There are some ways that you can connect and some ways that you can't directly connect based upon how they set the protocols and such. So, you know, computers are confusing, complicated, and no one understands them 100%. So I could understand why you're getting different answers. If you find that a different provider is giving you access, it speaks more of a problem with port blocking on your provider than the guy at the server. But who knows? I wish you good luck, though, with it, Nick.
Yes, to end with a comment?
I get on American Link through the hotspot that I have, a Blue DV Mega. It allows me to use all three modes. I can use D-Star Fusion and DMR using the same software. I just click click to a different mode. And actually, there's plenty of contact. As a matter of fact, I just spoke to a guy in Florida on American Link Fusion, and he was using Fusion in Florida. And it's pretty much the same. It doesn't really matter. I mean, D-Star, Fusion, to me, DMR, they're all pretty much the same, except maybe one has there's more more going on one than the other. You know, more contact and more people. But that's about it. They seem to work the same, you know. If I didn't know I was using Fusion or DMR, if I had a blindfold on, I wouldn't know, I was talking to somebody whether it was D-Star, Fusion, DMR, I wouldn't really know.
With you, Nick, there are some people who like the sound quality of one digital voice mode versus the other, but I usually, when people ask my opinion, I tell them to figure out the people you want to talk to, which mode they're using, and then use that mode, because it's probably more important the people on the other end than the technology that connects you to them. Jason, you wanted to say something.
Yes, thanks, Roy. I just wanted to add that you could call your internet service provider and just, let them know that that is a service that you use. And, if at all possible, if they are blocking it, to remove it. There are also ways, if you are slightly technically inclined, that you can test connectivity to the reflector yourself to see where the connection is being dropped, so that you may be able to tell on which end you're having the problem, whether it's the ISP or whether the reflector, the server, that's hosting that service is dropping your connection. And that program is called TraceRoute, if you're on a Windows computer. Also Linux, I think, as well, or Mac. It's tracert.exe.
Very good, Jason. Yeah, TraceRoute is a nice little program. It basically pings the server you're looking for and reports the time delay. And if the link doesn't make it all the way, it tells you the last relay that it failed at. So it might be useful. I don't know, calling these cable companies and such, I forget if it was a cable company. I think it was a cable company that is your primary internet provider. They tend not to know what you're talking about. I mean, I guess theoretically you might be able to talk your way into a technical guy there who could help you, but I don't know. Anyway, I wish you good luck. Anyone else have any comments, questions, answers about this particular topic? Once again, this is AC2GS Roy here with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. It meets every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. If anyone have any questions of a technical nature, or any comments or anything that you need to say on the technical net, feel free to hit that push to talk button.
AC2WTA, Joe.
Well, how's life treating you?
Not too bad. Roy, some time ago, maybe about a year ago, I was talking about making a magnetic loop antenna, and I had got a hold of a vacuum capacitor, and I wanted to make the antenna so I could access 80 and 160 meters. And in the interim, I found that I could get 80 and 160 with a full-size G5 RV. And I'm going to drop. But I think I could still make a magnetic loop for 10 meters. Roy, do you think a magnetic loop would help on 10 meters with the bad propagation conditions and the phase of the solar cycle that we're in? KC2, WTA.
I think a magnetic loop is a very nice design. It has some compromise aspects to it, we've talked about before, and power limitations because of the incredibly high Q and thereby the high voltage potential between the two plates of the capacitor, which is why a vacuum capacitor is a very useful thing to use. It's not a panacea per se. It's a great design in that you don't have to worry about the elevation as you do with your G5RV. If you put your G5RV, you know, 7 or 8 feet off the ground, it really wouldn't be too good. You got to give it a little bit of elevation for it to work, whereas the magnetic loop will tolerate 6-7 feet off the ground without any problem. So it's good as far as a small, compact, and limited height radiator, as long as you keep in mind the power ratings of your variable capacitor. Still, propagation is the limiting factor. You can have a great takeoff angle and a good energy efficiency, and you may be hurt a little bit better for people around you with a ground radiation, you know, ground wave. But the ionospheric radiation with the low sunspot cycle, it hasn't built up a high F1, F2 ionosphere, and so your 10 meters is more than likely going to not bounce and refract off of it, but to go sailing right past the ionosphere into space. That's why it's very iffy that we end up talking to people in Florida or down south. Sometimes there's a little bit of ionosphere that are bouncing the RF back down to ground. But for the most part, as you've noticed listening to the 10-meter net, it's been a rather local affair.
Okay, I think I read somewhere that the magnetic loop is more efficient transmitting on the ground wave. That's what led me to believe it might have some advantage in poor propagation conditions. And by the way, I had company here on Sunday, and after they took off, I turned the rig on. I heard the very tail end of the Sunday 10-meter net. I think you guys went to about 1 o'clock, is that right?
Yeah, Joe, we went to about 1 o'clock, and there was a severe case of spring fever. I think when I shut it down, there were maybe two other people left there who hadn't turned off their radios and gone out to look at the sunshine.
Okie doke. Yeah, I was sitting here with people having coffee and cake, so I didn't have to bring up. Well, that's it tonight. KC2, WTA on the side.
Very good, Joe. And as far as the magnetic loop, the story usually, if you go on the HF bands and such, people will tell the story that magnetic loops are less sensitive to electrical interference. They're more sensitive, they think, to magnetic fields than electric fields. I kind of doubt that. So that's one of the reasons people give for why they have a better reception with their magnetic loop, because the local electric field interference is not as much of a problem. I haven't quite heard of ground wave propagation being incredibly better per se. You know, when propagation conditions are halfway decent, you could use a magnetic loop to make a long distance transmission. They'll skip off the ionosphere as well as many other antennas. So it's not that it's either a ground plane heavy type of propagation of the radiation, or it's what's called also a vertical incident sky wave, in which it just kind of bounces down the waves, you know, and you get a nice local reception. But anything farther than, say, 10, 20 miles, the signals are, you know, they just bounce straight up and down. They don't go anywhere. But I wish you good luck with it. You should certainly consider it. If you have the parts for it, it at the very least is a educational experience.
A 10-meter loop would only need one length of copper pipe to do that. I was looking at designs for 80 and 160-meter band, which would take like 40 feet of copper pipe to wind. So I'm glad I didn't run out and buy all that stuff. Yeah, it's something to think about, but right now I have to try to stay on my the new high-frequency station. I have all the mechanical work inside done, and now I have to get outside. So this is my final, AC2GS, KC2WTA.
Very good, Joe. Anyone else with any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, or wants to talk about any of the subjects that we brought up earlier? Well, so let's go directly then to the technical puzzle. Once again, if your monitor on your computer seems to distort when you're transmitting your RF, the best measure to take initially to remove that problem, and there's four choices. A is reduce the resolution of the monitor. B is reboot the computer. C is change to a screened mains lead. And D is fit some ferrite rings on the cable between the monitor and the computer. Anyone want to play?
WF2N with an answer.
Very good, Jason. Give me the answer.
We go with option D, the ferrite rings.
You are absolutely positively right. Changing the resolution of your monitor isn't going to have any effect on this, and rebooting your computer probably won't unless the RF really messed up with your computer a lot. Changing a screen main, nah. The problem is that the common mode radio frequency waves are getting into your computer equipment and wreaking havoc. They're inducing currents that don't belong there, and distortion and all kinds of terrible things. I had a case where I have a macro keyboard with little LCD displays that run on a USB connection. And when I was running the 10-meter net, they would blink every so often. So I decided to get rid of it, and the easiest way, if you put a ferrite torus, you could either have a snap-on ring, or you can string around a torus, a donut shell. And what that effectively does is it increases the impedance of the common mode current that's causing the interference. It acts like, it's an impedance. It's not really a resistance, but they impede current as well. So if you apply enough impedance, you get less and less of that effect. So when I first did that with the 10-meter net, it didn't have any particularly useful effect. It still blinked. So I got a bigger choke with a larger hole in the middle, and instead of wrapping the wire twice around the ferrite, I wrapped it four times, which basically increases the impedance by a factor of four because it's a square function. And it went away. It didn't blink at all last Sunday. So when in doubt, and sometimes this is used as kind of the ultimate answer for everything, it's sort of the radio version of someone who has a problem with their computer and the guy says, have you tried turning it off and on? You know, the answer is always, well, put some ferrites in it. And a lot of time it's because the ferrites actually help. So if you have a common mode RF problem and you're getting radio frequency current inside electrical equipment that you don't want it to be inside there, you can shield the equipment, but the fastest, easiest way is finding the wires that are acting as antenna, and at the place that they go into the device, wrapping a ferrite a few times and increasing the impedance to the RF current, and you should be good. So that's the question for tonight. Basically, try ferrites. They're incredibly inexpensive. Everyone should have a drawer with a bunch of them just in case, because you never know when you're going to need one. So, anyone with any further questions or comments or anything, for the technical net tonight.
To end with a comment.
Just comment away.
Just wanted to say that your suggestion of buying a or using a larger bead or toroid with a larger hole to wrap it around more times is something that maybe some folks hadn't considered. So thank you for mentioning that, because I think some folks think that you snap the bead on or wrap it around as many times as maybe Emmanuel said, and they never gave thought to trying something like that and trying to wrap it around more times to multiply the effect. So thanks for that.
Welcome, Jason. Yeah, it makes sense technically, and you do it enough times and you realize that, in this case, it made a dramatic difference. It made the difference between it blinking and not blinking, which is you know, what I was after. So sometimes the cheap ferrites, you have to kind of look and hold it in your hand and figure out how much mass there is to it, because the more ferrite material, the greater the inductance that you're causing to occur. And the higher the inductance, the higher the impedance. The higher the impedance, the lower the current of the common mode. So you can either get a big chunk of metal, or you could just keep wrapping it around and know that if you wrap it, as I said, if you wrap it twice as many times, you get approximately four times the impedance. If you wrap it three times the previous amount, you get nine times the impedance. So it depends on how big your ferrite is and how much you need to impede that current. Some sources don't require that much. If you're lucky, one or two loops around is all that you need, and it goes away. But these things do not stop RF current. They impede it, they diminish it, they attenuate it. So there's a certain amount that you're going to have to suffer through. Hopefully it'll be below the threshold where the electronic equipment notices it and has any effect on it. So just one of those little things you pick up, but I'm glad I could pass that on to the people. Any other questions or comments tonight? This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be May 1st. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club repeater KC2RC, and a weekly swap and shop in digital fusion mode every Friday at 9 p.m. as well. If you can communicate using fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the fusion net and the swap and shop on the internet, as well as audio transmissions of our club repeater in general. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are, of course, welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. Once again, an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website to participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. So, as the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut this all down for now, but we'll be back to do it all over again April 24th, and you're all welcome to join us. I'd like to thank all the people that participated tonight, and especially Jason, WF2N. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys.
Thank you, Roy, and good evening to you and to everyone on the net.